I was reminded recently about something I heard Sylvia Boorstein once teach or say. Sylvia Boorstein is one of the Spirit Rock teachers and a colleague of mine, a friend of mine. And she was commenting on her observation that she had spent a lot of time in Buddhist practice centers with a lot of people who were very senior practitioners, long-term practitioners. A lot of them had been teachers, teaching for a long time. And her observation in knowing these people, what they had in common, she said, was that they felt that everything, whatever happened to them in their life, it was all manageable. They could manage it. It was manageable. It was workable. And on the surface, that can seem like maybe not a very illustrious, glorious description of people who are quite mature and developed in their practice. But I'd like to use that then as a little bit, as a beginning of a discussion, a little bit about one of the very basic, important teachings of the Buddha around meditation or spiritual practice. The context of spiritual practice in ancient India for the Buddha and other people besides him was one of the idea that things were workable. Sylvia used the word manageable. The notion of what was true, spiritually true, was a pragmatic criteria. Modern philosophers say the Buddha had a pragmatic theory of truth, meaning that you'd have found out what was true because it worked, because it was workable, because it worked. It led someplace. It was beneficial. It was helpful. And so there wasn't these you know, kind of ultimate propositions about the nature of reality or something, but rather it was very simple. It was the basic propositions of Buddhism, the truths, have to do with discovery that how things are workable, how you can work with them, how you can manage with your experiences in life. And how you can relate to the challenges of your life, the difficulties of your life, in a way that frees you. When you have a pragmatic theory of truth, when you're interested in kind of what's workable, then it's very important to have some idea of direction you're going. What does working look like? Or what is the result of making things work? Or if you're trying to do things which are helpful, you have to have some sense of what it is, the state you're going towards, what's healthy or helpful or beneficial. And so without some clear understanding of that goal, it's very hard to know how to measure, discern what is it that's helpful and what's not helpful, what works, and what should you do, how should you apply yourself. So the Buddha started with our basic kind of human condition that many of us share, that many of us in some way or other suffer. There's anxiety, there's tension, there's stress, there's confusion, there's many things. Shorthand, the Buddha called it suffering. And the basic teachings of Buddhism could be summed up in saying that even though people suffer, it's workable. It's possible to relate to it, engage in our suffering in such a way that we can be liberated from that suffering, such a way that we can find ourselves freed of it, so that the way in which our heart or our mind gets contracted or constricted or burdened or pressed by stress or by fear or hate or resentment or all these things, that all those things can be, it's workable, it's malleable. So you're not stuck with it. It's not something that this is the way it has to be the rest of your life. But something you can do, you can engage in a process that's helpful to release your heart and your mind so that your mind and the heart can be unshackled. Your heart and the mind can be unburdened, can be free, can be as free as a breeze in the spring, spring sky, as it said sometimes. So in that, Buddhist spirituality is looking at what's workable. How do we, if you can work and engage in something, apply yourself to how you're relating to the world, what your mind, your experience is, and make some kind of change to it. You can maybe understand why one of the most important criteria or foundations for all this is faith. Or the actual word is maybe better, confidence. To have confidence that you can engage in a process of working with stuff, of applying yourself, and can get results. And unless you have faith, I don't want to use the word faith, I want to use the word confidence. Unless you have confidence, you're not going to apply yourself. The more confidence you have, the more wholeheartedly, more fully you can engage yourself in the process that you're going to do. So you need some kind of confidence. So the Buddha said you start with your condition, your suffering, whatever that might be, and then you have to have some confidence in something that you're willing to apply yourself in the midst of that situation to see if you can make a difference. So you find yourself in a situation where you're quite tense. Maybe you're worried about something about to happen. You have to give a talk or talk to someone you're nervous about talking to. And so you recognize that, you know that, and you realize, well, this is a workable situation. And perhaps you've learned that by being with your breathing, by breathing deeply, just being with your breath and breathing mindfully over and over again, that somehow it takes the sting out of your nervousness. It takes the inhibition that might be there around so you can engage in a useful way. Or perhaps you've learned how to bring your mindfulness to bear on the fear and anxiety you have. Feel it in your body. Be really present for it. And in that presence, maybe you can learn how to dissolve it or how you understand the roots of it. Maybe you see you're just very discerning. You notice it in the roots of your anxiety. Is you're really concerned that this person likes you, that sees you in a positive way. And then you analyze and discern, what's that about? Why should I be concerned about this? I mean, it seems like a reasonable thing that everybody should like you, but there are neurotic ways that people live where they're completely preoccupied about whether people like them or not, how you're accepted and approved. When I was in the monastery kitchen, where I spent a year, the first 3 months I was just a regular kitchen hand, and I loved it. And after 3 months, I was made kind of the kitchen manager. And suddenly, I was in charge of the kitchen crew and getting things done and making sure the meals came out in time. And I was kind of like, you know, the operations manager. And one of the things I became painfully aware of in that role was how much I wanted people to like me, this crew of people. And it became painful because as the manager, I had to tell people, I had to kind of, that they had to do it a little differently, or, you know, they couldn't do what they wanted, or I had to kind of correct people. And I remember once telling someone in the monastery that things in a Zen monastery are very choreographed and very particular. And so it was very important that the cucumbers got cut to the size that they could be offered to the monks meditating in their small bowl that was really small. They had a small little bowl for their salads. And it's in the meditation hall, in the kind of context of meditating these monks are eating. And so it was very important those cucumber pieces could fit into that little thing. So I had to go tell this person, you know, excuse me, but those cucumber slices you're slicing have to be a little bit smaller. She started crying. Partly what happens in a monastery, it's kind of like a pressure cooker, where a lot of the, because people are practicing so intensely and so engaged in their spiritual life, their inner life, there's nothing else going on, there's no distractions. And so things that are usually maybe we kind of easily kind of not affect us in normal life can affect you really big time in a monastery because our issues are kind of up in a sense. Some people think a monastery is a place where everything is cool and peaceful and, you know, enlightened retirement. And monasteries are often actually the opposite. You know, rather than escaping from the world, it's actually, you know, you plunge yourself into your world in a much more sometimes intense way than you can if you're in the world shopping and watching television and all the ways in which we distract ourselves. So my role is very consequential in people's lives. And I recognized after a few months that it was just a dead end to be constantly neurotically preoccupied whether people liked me or not. And it made my job a lot more difficult for myself, and it also made my job a lot more difficult for other people. Always trying to say things in such a way that they would still like me and all that. And I learned that it worked a lot better if I just kind of let go of that concern. I mean, I still try to be decent and, you know, kind to everyone, but I wasn't kind of constantly kind of like a trapped rat kind of looking to see, you know, what people liked me, you know. So we use mindfulness to kind of be with our anxiety, perhaps, if we're anxious, or fear. And then maybe you start seeing some of the beliefs that are feeding into that are causing it to arise. And maybe it has to do, for example, with me those years ago, with my desire, my wish to be liked. And behind that, perhaps, was some kind of insecurity. So the mindfulness can reveal these things and sometimes dissolve them. Or make it workable, make it so they don't stand in the way anymore. So we start with our situation and we have confidence that things are workable, and then we apply ourselves to the situation in some way or other. So confidence is the foundation, and then there's the application, which in shorthand in Buddhism is called making effort. There is no spiritual life without some kind of effort. And effort is a huge topic, because you don't want to make striving effort and grit your teeth and kind of barrel ahead. But you also don't want to be complacent. And some people have kind of magical thinking about meditation. You know, just, oh, if I just sit there, then something will happen. And I'll, you know, get enlightened, or something wonderful will happen. Everything, all my problems will go away. And sometimes you have beginner's luck at first, because people are so, you know, stressed out. They're just sitting doing nothing. You know, it calms them down. But then I've known people who spent years, you know, once the beginner's kind of stage passed, and they were kind of just waiting for something to happen, as if they didn't have to do anything. There is no Buddhist spirituality with some kind of engagement, some kind of effort. We apply ourselves some way. Very simply, you know, you have to make the effort to get to your meditation cushion. And as some of us know, that takes some effort sometimes. Sometimes our life is busy, and sometimes there's demands on us. Sometimes we're tired. Sometimes, you know, there's internal resistances for many reasons to sitting down to meditate. And so we have to make the effort to sit and meditate. And sometimes it takes a lot of effort to, okay, this is what I'm going to do, no matter what. Sometimes it's quite easy. And then once you're sitting in the cushion, then there has to be some kind of effort there. And, you know, the effort at least to turn your attention to your breath. Or your effort at least maybe to let go of all your thinking. Or to not invest yourself in your thinking anymore. Or perhaps it's the effort to accept what's there unconditionally. That's a kind of an effort to make. Unconditional acceptance. Maybe Tara Brach talked about radical acceptance last week. A couple weeks ago. This idea of... But that also is a kind of effort to accept everything. And it's a very radical effort, because many of us live a life where non-acceptance is a characteristic feature of it. We don't accept something. We don't accept some aspect of ourselves. We don't accept some aspect of what's going on around us. And so that non-acceptance is a cornerstone for much of our behavior and motivations for what's going on in our life. Perhaps I mean, I think in some ways a consumer culture is dependent on people who have some level of non-acceptance. Because if you simply accepted your life as it was, you wouldn't buy a lot of things. And so if you think your life's going to be acceptable more by getting things, by buying things, then that implies that, you know, what's happening now is unacceptable. So if it takes some analysis, you can kind of look at it in your life. You know, how does non-acceptance of something play itself out in how you think and how you talk and how you behave and what motivates you? Are you motivated by some kind of non-acceptance? If you start practicing radical acceptance, it kind of pulls the rug from underneath the cornerstone of what props up a lot of people's psyche. And it's quite liberating to discover the alternative. Even that's kind of an effort. Sometimes the effort is heroic. And sometimes it's quite delightful and easeful. Sometimes it feels like you're mountain climbing. It's really, you know, to make the effort and be present and show up in the practice and to get concentrated. And sometimes it feels like just you're on a kind of wonderful, soft, gentle raft that just be going downstream, just carrying you along, just delightful to kind of be in there. And you come along and there's the eddies, you know, and you have to kind of stir the boat a little bit so you don't kind of get caught in the eddies or in the side, in the branches on the side or something. And you have to make some effort, but it's mostly effortless effort. But there's effort as part of spiritual, you have to apply yourself to some degree. If you spend a lot of time reading spiritual books, which some people do, it can offer a lot of confidence to people, a lot of faith, a lot of inspiration. But sooner or later, you realize that reading spiritual books is kind of like going to the restaurant and just reading the menu. You know, over and over, the menus are interesting. And you can have great, you know, and you can compare menus in different restaurants and, you know, all kinds of things. You can spend a long time on the menu. But you have to, at some point, you have to order the food and eat the food. So same thing with a spiritual life. At some point, you have to apply yourself and do something. You have to start living the contemplative life, whatever living is. I think of a spiritual life as a life that you live. It's a life. So you have to engage in that life in some way. So based on confidence, we apply ourselves. The greater the confidence, the more wholeheartedly we apply ourselves. Once we apply ourselves, what we apply ourselves to, it tends to bring more presence, more mindfulness. We're more awake or more attentive to what's going on in the present moment, generally. So it's said that out of this application, out of this effort, comes greater mindfulness, greater ability to track what's going on, greater ability to be in the present as things are going on. And this is really one of the pivotal things that we're trying to do in mindfulness practice, is simply the ability to show up moment by moment, to show up what's going on, to be present for our experience. And it's a really beautiful thing, the idea of presence or mindfulness. It's the ability to recognize what's happening in the present moment without resisting it or being in conflict with it, or without holding on to it or clinging to it. So it's the ability kind of non-discursively to allow things to be as they are. There's another quality of mindfulness that is often, I think, not so well appreciated. And that is that mindfulness has a cognitive element to it. There's kind of an alert clarity when it's strong, when mindfulness is strong. Alert clarity, of recognition. Oh, this is what's happening now. It doesn't have to be like words like that so much. But you're kind of awake. So you really, it's kind of like the difference between maybe driving your car or your glasses, which is my experience often enough, maybe having dirty, you know, but maybe, you know, some of you have glasses, you know, and you go around with your glasses and you're kind of engaged in the world, and then someone says, you know, yeah, I think you should clean your glasses. And then you clean your glasses and go, whoa. And suddenly things are clear. And you kind of see more clearly. So, and you go, oh, I didn't realize, you know, that, you know, this and that. And so there's a clarity that happens as mindfulness becomes stronger. And that clarity has a quality of energy to it, of effort, kind of delightful, clear effort. And sometimes the effort of being mindful can sometimes feel like you're just kind of making the effort, making the effort, making the effort, and you're waking up. It can have great fruit to do that way. And at some point, it clicks in. And it becomes like this clarity kind of clicks, or so there's a shift, a relaxation that happens. And then the mind starts kind of being almost effortlessly aware. Or there's clarity. Oh, you start recognizing things. Oh, this is what's there. This is what's happening. This is what's happening here. And you're not trying to struggle anymore to be present for what's going on. The mind is not taking you off into the past and the future anymore. But now the mind is kind of settled in the present moment. Oh, here I am. And okay. And the mind is not trying to do something else anymore. It's not trying to run away or have a conversation with someone or all things it wants to do. But the mind now, oh, here it is. It's like, oh, I've arrived. I went to a concert many years ago, symphony. And I don't go to symphonies very often. Someone gave me tickets and I went. And I noticed that there were two halves with intermission. And in the first half of the symphony, I noticed very quickly that it was hard for me to pay attention to the music. because we were sitting in the seats where we could watch the orchestra really, really well, and there was so much going on, and I kept being distracted by this conductor, you know, doing all this stuff with his hands, and all these players doing different things, and all these instruments, and you know, it's a big symphony, and it was, you know, it was very distracting. I had thoughts about what I was seeing, and fascinated by who was going to be next, and judging this person and that, and you know, all the kind of things my mind was doing. And I noticed that I wasn't really tracking the music. So finally what I did was I closed my eyes because I was there for the music. And that cut out the kind of visual stimulation, and that actually stopped the proliferation of thoughts and ideas about it. And I can just be with the music. And so I stayed with the music and stayed with the music. And then at some point, I think it was the second half of the show, then my mind relaxed enough. It stopped its incessant kind of reaching out outside of itself to think about or judge or consider or, you know, what was going on. And it stopped that kind of searching outside of itself. And the mind became settled and relaxed enough that I could keep my eyes open and be clearly aware of the music, just be with the music. So there's a shift that happens. So the mindfulness practice is the same way. There's a period of time when we're kind of making the effort to be present, making the effort to the present. And there's often a very strong counterforce within us not to be present. It's very important then to be very accepting of that and just not take it personally and not take it as a failing and not fight against it or be angry about that's the way it is. But just have the confidence that this is workable. I can keep engaging. It's useful to do this. And it's not useful to judge it or be discouraged. I'll just be patient with it. And just keep showing up. Keep showing up. The mind wanders away. You come back. You show up. What's here? And then at some point, sooner or later, maybe it's more often later than sooner, the mind, there's a shift. And at some point, the mind has become, in classic Buddhism, they call it, say, the mind has become tamed, the taming of the mind. The mind is, and I don't know if that's an analogy that, or metaphor that works for you, any of you here, but they just finally, the mind's been tamed, like a wild puppy, or a wild horse or something, that has to be trained. And finally, it's been trained. It's calmed down. It's been tamed. It's not going to be running off in all kinds of directions anymore. But it's just here, ready to do work. And then the mind becomes really workable. And that gives a lot of confidence because, wow, now I have this instrument, the instrument of the mind, of awareness, which now I can start using. Before, I was just getting it to show up and applying it in a good way. But now it's here. And I'm really confident it's going to stay here for a while. And then you start applying it more fully. And as the attention is more fully here and more usable and can be applied and the forces of the mind are not taking you away so much, then the mind starts becoming concentrated. The mind starts getting composed and collected and unified. The mind is not fragmented anymore, going off in all kinds of different directions. And the mind starts settling down, get more and more focused, more concentrated, more penetrating with that ability to be mindful. And it begins penetrating kind of underneath the veils, underneath the surface chatter of the mind, to see much more deeply what's going on within us and around us. And this in return, so you have this sequence from confidence to application to mindfulness to concentration. And the last of these sequence then is what the Buddha called discernment. With a mind that's engaged, mindful, focused, you have the ability to start becoming discerning, to notice what's going on in the present moment and be discerning about what is useful and not useful to do with your mind and your heart, with your thoughts, with your feelings. What is it's going on now, and what can you let go of? What can you pick up? If you want the mind to become peaceful, if you want the mind to become still, beautiful stillness, contemplative stillness, then can you become discerning of what supports that? And what is it that detracts from that? So this is where, again, there's some work involved in this kind of spiritual life. It's not just the magic and waiting for something to happen, but you're actually kind of beginning to take some responsibility for not just your behavior, but you actually learn to take responsibility for your mind, what your mind does. You don't have to take your mind as something that's fixed and just has a mind of its own. But as the mind settles down, you begin kind of, oh, I don't have to think that anymore. I can let go of those kinds of thoughts. I don't have to be engaged in that kind of activity or that kind of those kinds of feelings. You know, I've had resentful thoughts for a long time. I don't have to be fueling them or feeding them with more stories. I've learned that forgiveness is a very powerful and useful thing that helps things, you know, become more peaceful. So I think I'll engage in some forgiveness practice here, some loving kindness practice. So there's a discerning quality of finding our way towards greater peace, greater stillness, greater settledness. Maybe I need to be even more concentrated. So apply ourselves to be more concentrated. These five qualities, confidence, application, mindfulness, concentration, and discernment, are five activities, in a sense, that you all of you are already doing. I think what the Buddha did was he took things that's familiar with all of us, not necessarily because you've thought about it, but if you think about it a little bit, you realize you all use this all the time. These five things. They're not foreign things you have to apply to your life from outside, from Buddhism. Say that you're a bicyclist. Maybe because a Tour de France is happening, it's kind of on my mind a little bit, but say that you're a bicyclist. And you have to, you know, you're going up a few mountains and down a few mountains and going someplace. The first thing you have to, it helps to have some confidence that, you know, I can do this. I can ride this bike for a couple of hours and go over these hills and make my way there. And without some kind of confidence, it's hard. It's actually more tiring to do if you don't have confidence because you're constantly doubting and wondering if you're going to make it and all that. So some confidence in your abilities. And then you have to engage yourself in bicycling. You can't just sit, you know, at the coffee shop with your bicycle parked outside and think about how wonderful it is to go biking and have your suit on and everything and your helmet on. And then after you finish having your coffee, you go home and take a shower and say, that was great. It might have been great, but it's not biking. So you have to make the effort. You have to show up and be there. And then there has to be some tracking of what's going on, which is the mindfulness. You have to be able to track what's happening as things are happening. So you're tracking. That's the distance I have to go. So I have to moderate my speed a little bit here. Now the hill's going up. Now it's going down. Here's a car that's coming. Now I'm thirsty. So you're tracking all these things. You're present for what's going on. Unless you're able to be present and track, you can't really, you know, make all the changes you have to do with the biking that's going on all the time. And then it helps to be focused and concentrated to some degree. It's very important to be discerning, because you have to be discerning enough to know what does it take to make this trip work. If you go all out on the first hill, you're not going to make it all the way. So you have to know when you start going up a hill, you have to slow down. When you come over the crest of the hill and you're going down on the other side, then your discernment tells you, I don't have to make much effort now. And that actually, maybe it's better to use this time to rest and regather myself for the next hill. So the idea of confidence, application or effort, mindfulness, concentration and discernment, I think are there in some degree in all activities we're doing. So the issue in meditation is, how are these playing themselves out in meditation? Can you use these things as a way of enhancing the quality of your meditation practice? Part of what we can track are these five things in meditation. How is your confidence today or now when you sit down to meditate? Is your confidence really low? Maybe you fell off the bicycle. Whatever that means in meditation experience. You fell off, you know, your cushion. You know, you had some really bad meditation experience or whatever. And so you come back with kind of shaken. You know, you don't have much confidence. Or, you know, there's other reasons not to have much confidence. And you don't have much confidence that day. Or maybe you have a lot of confidence, but for some reason now you don't have a lot of confidence in the practice. I've heard there are different kinds of mindfulness practices, you know, and there's this way of doing it and that way of doing it and this way of doing it, and how do I know which one is the best, you know, and which one's the best for me, and maybe I don't really have the best practice, and, you know. So then there's doubt about the practice, which keeps us inhibited, keeps us held back from our ability to apply ourselves, engage in the practice that we're doing. So there's confidence in ourselves, confidence in the practice. There's also confidence about the goal of the practice, the confidence that the practice leads someplace that's useful. If you have no confidence it's going to lead someplace that's useful, then probably you're not going to apply yourself very wholeheartedly, even if you do it. But if you have some real confidence that, yes, I can do this, and it leads a place which is really good, then you can apply yourself more wholeheartedly. If you think that destination is fantastic, if you think like it's the best thing going, then probably you'd apply yourself with much more enthusiasm. If you think, you know, it's good, you know, it's okay, but, you know, sex is better, or food is better, or whatever, a big bank account is better, or a bigger house is better, or being a better conversationalist is better, or, you know, getting a massage is better, or all there's all these other things that pull the mind, then it might be we hold ourselves back from really applying ourselves as wholeheartedly as we can. And all of us will have different degrees of confidence in all these things I'm talking about, but these are all elements that feed into meditation practice. Is the element of confidence in these different things, and you can actually work on that confidence. You can work on your own self-confidence. You can work on having more confidence in the practice. You can work on having more confidence in the goal of practice by understanding what it is, understanding some ideas of the teachings of the Buddha, or talking to other people who are further along than you, and they say, oh yeah, this is some of the things you can expect, or this is what can happen, this is how it's workable and how things can be improved. And then a lot of people have some degree of confidence, will have confidence, but they don't use it very often. They don't fall back on it. They don't remind themselves, oh, I have a lot of confidence here. And sometimes it's very, can be very useful to kind of remind oneself, to reflect on what you do have confidence in, and to call forth that confidence. There's a way of calling forth the confidence as you begin your meditation practice. Classically in Asia, in Theravada and Buddhism, people are instructed to, at the beginning of meditation, to spend a few minutes reflecting on the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. To reflect on those is a way of reminding ourselves of our confidence, to eliciting confidence, evoking confidence. The idea of application or making effort to actually track what's happening to my effort level here. Am I applying myself as well as I can? One of the interesting things to do is at the end of a meditation session to reflect back on the meditation session and reflect a little bit, did I really apply myself as well as I could have in that session? Not to judge yourself and feel depressed or whatever, but I find sometimes for myself that, oh, you know, I let some period of time of meditation slip by where I was pretty complacent. You know, I had this great thought, or I had this really lousy thought or whatever, and I just let myself kind of go with it for a while, and I was for 5 or 10 minutes thinking about, you know, how wonderful it would be to have a vacation, where I would go, and this and that, and what I would do, and you know, the menus I'd study, and I just let myself drift on that for a while, and you know, I didn't really apply myself. I could have easily. There wasn't much point to that kind of drifting, and in fact, I could have applied myself much better. And that kind of reflection at the end of meditation practice is not meant to be a burden, but that's very simple recognition that was actually how it was. Will help condition the mind to be a little bit more diligent in the future. To recognize, make yourself a little bit more cognizant next time. Oh, I think I'm being complacent here. If you track over many meditation sessions what's going on, you keep a meditation journal and keep track, then you might start noticing patterns. You know, I'm complacent every time. If someone had asked me, I would have said, oh, you know, once a week or so, I kind of a little bit, you know, complacent. But I didn't realize I was kind of like just, you know. And so then, oh, okay, I think I'm going to apply myself more, a little bit more in the future. And how well are you tracking what's going on? How well are you mindful of what's happening at the present moment? And just simply switching the words from mindfulness to tracking might make it a little bit more understandable what you can do and help you kind of be more in the present, to track what's happening within the present moment, to track your breathing, to enter the present moment very diligently that way. To be discerning, to be a little bit wise about what's actually happening here, what's useful here. If you're really tired, when you sit down to meditate, then be discerning. What's useful to do? Maybe you have to make more effort, mental effort, to stay alert, to stay awake, to stay present. You're more likely to drift off complacently. Or maybe you have to open your eyes or stand up or do walking meditation. Or if you're really stressed, perhaps you want to be really relaxed in your meditation. And maybe if you're really stressed, you don't want to be very discerning. You don't want to apply yourself too much because it just kind of adds salt to the wound of stress. And you just want to be very, very, almost complacent maybe even if you're really stressed out for a while. And sometimes I find it useful for me in my meditation, depending on what's going on, especially if I meditate at the end of the day, to let the first 5 or 10 minutes of a meditation session be bordering on complacency. Just kind of I'm not really trying to do anything, I'm not trying to accomplish anything, and I have this idea that I'm trying to be mindful, but I'm not really making any serious effort to be mindful. I do occasionally. I'm kind of with a breath, a couple of breaths, and wanders away, and I come back, and what I'm really doing there is just giving my mind a very, very wide pasture to relax and to unwind. And just it kind of seems like it really needs that sometimes if I'm kind of a little stressed or preoccupied or something. And after 5 to 10 minutes of that, then it seems to be time to, okay, now it's time to sharpen up a little bit. And now I can apply myself and now it's useful to do it. The mind is settled down and relaxed more. So to be discerning, what needs to be done here? Be discerning about what needs your attention. Sometimes it can seem like sometimes there's a lot of choices to be made in meditation. But there's a lot of choices you have to make when you ride a bike. But once you learn to ride a bike, it's kind of second nature to make these kind of choices. And you don't even think about slowing down when you start going up a hill or whatever you have to do to change. So with meditation, it's very much the same way. That there are choices you have to make as you find your way through meditation, and it seems like you can be very busy making all these choices, but the idea is to keep it simple. And as you stay simple with the meditation practice and track and learn, be present and learn from your experience, learn from doing it over the months and years, then it becomes second nature to notice what's going on and know what kind of choices you need to make. I'm feeling anxious. And I think in this kind of anxiety that I'm feeling now, I find the most useful thing to do is just be with the breath. Help me relax. Or a different kind of anxiety arises and you find, in this kind of anxiety, it's more useful to be with the tightness in my stomach. Or then you realize there's another kind of anxiety. And, with that kind of situation, it's much more useful to me to hang out with my beliefs. And try to understand, what am I really believing? What am I buying into that makes me more anxious? So the discernment kind of helps you kind of guide your attention to what needs attention for the purposes of release, for the purposes of helping you relax and let go of what's holding you and holding you tight. When I was practicing meditation in Southeast Asia, I was told once a few times that it was a job of the meditation teachers, when students came for interviews with a meditation teacher, to listen to see how these 5 faculties were playing themselves out in the person's meditation. And so to listen carefully, this person here needs more faith, this person here could use more application, apply themselves more, this person should apply themselves less, they're trying too hard, they're pushing too hard. This person should focus more on just being mindful, very simple mindfulness, and just do that. This person needs more concentration, needs to be calm, more relaxed. This person needs to be more discerning. And so the teachers are kind of listening to this. And try this and try that. And, this is what you need to bring some balance into the practice and follow along. It can seem like a lot. It can seem like you're making yourself busy. But if you're discerning, then you'll notice that a busy mind that's perplexed about what to do next is not a useful mind to have in meditation. So by learning to be discerning in meditation, your process of meditation hopefully is self-correcting, where you start noticing the ways in which you are in meditation, which is not conducive to greater peace and more greater wakefulness. If how you're meditating, how you're engaging it, is making you more anxious and more stressed, more busy, then the mindfulness and the discernment is supposed to show you that. And then you're supposed to make a correction for that. So I think of meditation as being self-correcting. So those are my thoughts for today. And you have any questions or comments or questions about something else you'd like to ask? Yes.
Kel, maybe we went over this, but could you summarize how you cultivate confidence? Because I find oftentimes when I have fear or anxiety in my life, is that I've gotten to the point where I don't feel things are manageable, and you kind of lose confidence at that point.
There's a lot of things can be said about that. One is, in terms of Buddhist spirituality, there's a very important distinction to be made between managing external events so that the external events turn out successfully versus managing our inner life so our inner life is not burdened by either success or failure. And if you confuse those two realms, then it's very hard to find the kind of confidence that the Buddha was pointing towards. Because there's no guarantee that anybody is going to be able to have all the wise understanding to know how to manage external events, so that the external events succeed in some way that you want them to succeed. But it is possible to have enough self-understanding and self, that and a spiritual practice that leads you to take care of your heart. So that even if things fail, you know how to take care of your heart, so your heart stays free, stays awake, stays compassionate, stays loving. And that's really that distinction. Then, if you understand that distinction, then you understand. Then it's a lot easier to understand where the direction of practice needs to be. The responsibility in practice is to learn to take responsibility for this part of what our heart does in any situation at all. And if realizing that, then maybe you can have. It's easier to know. Oh, I can have confidence in that, because if you can have confidence in managing in the external situation, that comes with experience. It comes with wisdom. It comes, it can come with many different kind of things, but there's no ultimate guarantee. So that's one thing. At least in spiritual confidence, is knowing what the proper domain of spirituality is. This is applicable in all situations because we bring our hearts everywhere. So it's not something that's just left for the meditation cushion. So it kind of covers the whole world in a sense. Your heart covers the whole world. So it's a very powerful thing to take care of and connect to. The other thing that can cultivate confidence is experience. So initially our confidence to begin meditation practice, for example, or begin a spiritual practice, maybe is we have confidence in someone we've met. We have confidence in some book we've read. Oh yeah, that I have some confidence in what this person's saying or how this person's demeanor is. So I think I'll give it a try. But as we engage in the practice, then through our own experience, we learn that it's useful, it's helpful. And as we learn from our own experience, then we have what's called verifiable faith, verified confidence. And then as practice deepens, then confidence grows and grows because we know how it is. So say you go to a situation where, you're at work and you have a deadline and you can't succeed to make your deadline and your boss is angry with you and you said, this is stressful, and all these people are yelling and upset with me and then you bring your attention to your stomach or your heart or someplace, you bring your attention inward and you realize how you've wound yourself up in a knot around this, and you learn, oh, you know, I can let go of this knot. I can soften, I can relax. And you find yourself able to relax in the middle of this very tense situation. And people are still angry with you, but you've learned, at least learned how not to be so tense. And then, because you're not so tense, then you know how to respond in a way that's not reactive. And maybe you don't yell back at them and say, you know, whatever you say. And you say, you know, this is really hard for me today. And you say something, you know, this is really hard for me today. And maybe I realize there's a problem, and let's sit down and talk about it together. And they say, oh, okay. And suddenly you have a lot of confidence in wow, I used my mindfulness practice and turned it into a situation that normally is very stressful for me, and it worked. It's workable. Things are where it worked. And that gives you some confidence. Oh, maybe I can do this again. So experience brings confidence. Another thing that brings confidence is understanding the teachings. Other people bring confidence. You see other people applying this and other people experiencing or living the results of that kind of spiritual practice. Oh, they can do it. So that gives me confidence it can be done. So sometimes there are external sources of confidence. And some people will like to read spiritual books sometimes in order to re-evoke their confidence and inspiration so that they can sit down and apply themselves. Sometimes the most useful way of most realistic way of cultivating confidence is paradoxically is not do it directly, but do it in the opposite direction by focusing on what the lack of confidence is all about. Question the lack of confidence and understand, you know, really bring your mindfulness to that phenomena. And because you don't want to simply kind of have a confidence that overrides a sense of insecurity or inadequacy. That's not very realistic. So sometimes, and then if you apply yourself to where you feel kind of have a lot of doubt, and you resolve the doubt, then you might naturally find yourself in a situation where you feel more confident because the doubt's no longer there. So those are some of my thoughts. Yes.
When you were saying that in meditation, if you anxious or fearful, you kind of might be in your stomach, or then if you find a tightness, say for instance in your stomach, do you bring your breath to the stomach and concentrate there?
You could. There's a couple of things you might try doing. One is simply to be aware that you're anxious. It's very helpful to be aware you're anxious. And then continue with your breath meditation. Just feel your breath. And just be with your breath and be with your breath. Because sometimes if you bring too much direct awareness to anxiety, some people actually get more anxious. But if you're simply aware of the anxieties there in the background, but kind of ignore it a little bit and just stay with your breathing, the breathing will calm a person down and help release some of it. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is to do exactly what you said, is to bring your attention there and then send your breath there. Massage it with your breath. Imagine your breathing kind of goes into that and it goes in and out of that place. So you have this kind of movement and massage and nurturing kind of presence that goes in and out. And that can actually be quite relaxing. Something else you might do is just forget about the breath entirely and just go directly in there and feel the physical sensations of tightness. And just feel that tightness in a very matter-of-fact, simple way, as if you're going to feel it forever. As if you're not trying to push it away or make it go away. Because if you want it to go away, it's kind of unfriendly. This poor tension in your stomach is going to feel, no one wants me, no one likes me, and this person I live with doesn't like me. And then it gets more tight and tense and upset and runs away and hides. So the best attitude is just, it's okay to be there, anxiety. It's okay to be there. I'm just going to hold you in my awareness. It's like a young girl, like a 5-year-old girl, for example, who is really afraid. You know, you don't go reason with her and say, well, these are the reasons why you shouldn't be afraid. Or, you know, what you do is you go over and just hold her. And you don't have to 5 minutes say, you know, you know, that was enough, you know. You know, you hold her however long she needs to be held. And you kind of hope that she eventually relaxes. But if you, but she feels like you have an agenda, you know. Are you relaxed yet? You know, she's going to get, you know, feel more intimidated. So the idea is to just bring your attention to that as if you're, you know, just a loving presence and a loving awareness. Just be aware. Just hold it, explore it, be with it. And maybe be with it for a long time. Explore it from different angles, in a sense. You know, look at it, from, be aware of it, sense it. That's another approach that can be very helpful. And as you do that, it might be helpful to start becoming aware of the emotions that are connected to the anxiety. Or maybe the anxiety moves through your body, energy is coursing through your body. And then you can just pretend there's a ping pong inside of you. Just close your eyes and just let the energy kind of move around. And you're just a container for it. The loving container just allows that ping pong ball just to kind of bounce around. So there's a number of different things to do. I'm sorry there's more than one thing to do, because that leaves people with choices, and you know, that's sometimes difficult. But that's the way it is. And so we have to be discerning and find our way. And trial and error, try different things at different times. But to have confidence that things are workable is really helpful. This anxiety of mine, I think it's workable. I think I can do it. Or at least, you know, I've been told it can be done. So I think I can, you know. For some people, it's so radical to find out that there is a practice they can engage this stuff in, that engage themselves with. And they don't have to be the victim of anxiety or fear or hate or anything like that. But rather, I can apply myself to it. I can do something. I can engage in it. And just simply that changes the inner ecology. So just that kind of makes a little bit more space, or makes you a little bit more independent from what's been oppressing you in the past. Oh, it doesn't have to be this way. I can engage. Great, let's do it. Is that helpful at all? In this model of understanding meditation practice, that we talk about the five faculties, that is very much a model of how a person is a craft, learns a craft, develops a craft, and the same things apply in a craft. And actually, the Buddha used a lot the craft analogy for developing the craft of meditation. So you have to apply yourself. You have to do it, practice on a regular basis. If you don't practice your craft every day, you're not really going to learn very fast. You have to track what's going on. You have to be focused. You have to be discerning. And you have to have confidence that this is worthwhile doing. So I hope this is helpful. I hope this inspires you and gives you a little pep talk and gives you some way of being engaged. And please remember what I said about the practice is meant to be self-correcting, so that you're really tracking what's going on enough to know when you're engaged meditatively in a way that's not helpful. And then make a course correction. And that'll always happen to you. Sooner or later, you'll find yourself going down a track that is not useful. Sometimes there's big swings. And especially when meditation gets more and more subtle and you get better and better meditating, then you find yourself making smaller swings. And don't disparage the fact that it's gone a little bit off track. That's the process of finding the track, is falling off a little bit. Okay, so let's end with a very short sitting. We'll have to do this meditation really fast. So, you know, get ready, on your mark. And it's a race. We'll see, but it's a wonderful competitive sport meditation, because we all arrive in the present moment at the same time. So is there some healthy and realistic way that you can use confidence? You can let confidence be a strength that supports your practice. Thank you, and I hope you have a wonderful week. Good night.